Okay, we're learning our Chaim Parshas Bamidbar, just right before Yom Tov Kabbalah Satara. There are two pieces in the Archaim I wanted to see tonight. First, the very first piece in Sefer Bamidbar, in Parshas Bamidbar, which is in this edition on page Aleph in the Bamidbar section. If you have a traditional Chumash, it's just the very first Archaim. You know, the Archaim comments on the opening Pasuk in Parshas Bamidbar by Davar Hashem al Moshe. Hashem said to Moshe, "Bemidbar Sinai ba'Oel Moed." He spoke to Moshe in the desert of Sinai, in the Oel Moed, be'Echod Lachodesh Hasheni, on the first of the second month. In other words, Rosh Chodesh Iyar, Bashona Hashenis Litzeisam Eretz Mitzrayim Leimor, in the second year after they had left Eretz Mitzrayim, saying as follows. It's a pasuk you read and you keep reading. You know, I mean, it's an introductory pasuk. Most people, I don't think, really sit on this pasuk very much. You certainly wouldn't be inclined, you know, to look for great insights of hashkafa, you know, or of emunah in this pasuk. And the godless, the greatness of the Arachayim, is he finds exactly that. In a pasuk which sounds like just, you know, an introductory sentence, you know, introducing the rest of the Sedra, he sees a yesod, the basic foundation in our belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. B'midbar Sinai, Razal Darshu Havanus Yikaros B'Pasuk Zeh. Right, first of all, he refers you to the Midrashim, the Midbar Rabbah, where there are many, many, you know, deep understandings of this Pasuk, and he adds his own. B'nisha Lahar, Lama Lohishma Hashem Yidosov Yisbarach B'Shura HaDvarim. If you really look at the Pasuk, there's a little bit of an inequity in the way the Pasuk is presented. What do I mean? Kishehizker Odoas HaMokom Hikvim Machteres HaKlolus Shul Midbar Sinai Ve'achakach Hizker Prat HaMokom Va'omar Va'olel Moed. He says, the Pasuk identifies there are two frames of reference here in the Pasuk. One is place, and the other is time. Where is the place that is identified in this Pasuk? The Midbar Sinai, the Oel Moed, in the desert of Sinai, in the Oel Moed, in the tent of meeting. On the surface, we're going from general to specific, right? It was in the Midbar, in the desert. Where in the desert? In the Oel Moed, right? Big to small. The second half of the Pasuk, which speaks in terms of the frame of reference of time, says that the revelation here took place on Rosh Chodesh Iyar in the second year. So there, we're actually going from specific to more general. Right? It's the opposite. We're starting with the day and then going outwards to the year. The year is a much more general frame of reference. If we want to be consistent, we should either describe the place as going from specific to general, or describe the time as going from general to specific. But, you know, we mix and match over here, right? Why is it that we mix and match? Kshehizkir Adras Hazman, Hiktim Zichron Prat Hazman, Yom HaDe'echa L'Chodesh HaSheni, when talking about time, in contrast to place, it first mentions the exact date, Yachakach Hizkir Machberes Kolos Hazman, but then it talks in more general terms, V'Ar Vashon HaShenis. It talks about the year. Why the inconsistency? Right? Something, again, I'll speak for myself. I never noticed this in however many years of reading the Pasuk. Right? Well, time comes, he says, you know, there's a certain inconsistency, a certain inequity in the way the Pasuk presents itself. So, okay, so your inclination is also to say, okay, no, that's how it is. No. He doesn't let it go. The Nirev, Ki Akosav Adarav, Hiskel Adavar Bishir Shavar. No, but if you really understand this Pasuk, says the Arachayim, the Pasuk really is incredibly consistent in the following way. Hu'al Derech Amram, it fits with what Chazal say, that when Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Hinei Mokom Iti, right, when Moshe Rabbeinu wants to be able to perceive some of God's essence, so Hashem says, okay, Hinei Mokom Iti, behold, there's a place with me, but it's Avdol Atzur. You stay in this rock, I'm going to pass forward in front of the rock, you'll see my back, you won't see my face, right? But that phrase, Hinei Mokom Iti, behold, there is a place with me. It's a very funny lashon. So Chazal darshan that pasuk in the following fashion. Shemekomo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, hu tofel lo. the place where God is to be found is always secondary to God Himself. The way Chazal darshan that pasuk, that phrase, "Hinei makom iti," is as follows: wherever I am to be found, the makom, the place, is with me. I'm not in the place. I don't define myself relative to the place.
I am the place,
and the place where I am defines itself relative to me. Right? I am the center of everything, and the place revolves around me. Right? That's.
He is.
Right, but you know, certainly we, you know, unfortunately, people can lose sight of that. I mean, you know, when we think about it, it's an obvious truth. If we believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu fills up everything, so we certainly understand that. But, consider a shul. I mean, people can get so caught up in the shul, they think of HaKadosh Baruch Hu perhaps as being even secondary to the shul itself. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was in the shul. Did he pay membership this year? You know, I mean, is he, does he have voting rights? You know, I mean, people can lose sight of the fact that no, the shul revolves around HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and not vice versa. Even the Beis Hamikdash is holy because of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Beis Hamikdash is secondary to Hashem, and not vice versa. That's why, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is called in the Lashon of Chazal Mokom HaMokom, right? Because who Mekomo Shalom. Right? Wherever God is, He's the place. Everything revolves around Him. It's not as if He's defined relative to anything else. Ule'erech zeh, in this sense, ye'etofel kol ha'mokom, l'gavi ha'mokom asher choneshom ho'elokim. Any place that can be defined as a godly place becomes the center, and even the greater place in which it's found is defined relative to that place where God is to be found. So with that yisod in mind, with that concept in mind, let's go back to the pasuk. Me'ata machberes haklolos hu oel moed, v'amidbar hu prat tofel lo. Now let's go back to the beginning of the pasuk. The pasuk says, Hashem spoke to Moshe, v'amidbar Sinai, right, in the desert, v'oel moed, in the tent of meeting, in the oel moed. So we thought that Midbar Sinai was the general description of where they were generally, and the Oel Moed is a more specific, you know, narrowing down the area. But now he says, no, it's not as if the Oel, you know, if you say Oel Moed is defined as a place within the Midbar Sinai, right, so then the Midbar Sinai is the point of reference that you use in identifying the Oel Moed. But it's not true. The Oel Moed is the point of reference you use in identifying the Midbar. Meaning, where is Midbar Sinai? Midbar Sinai is that place which envelops, which surrounds the Oel Moed in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is to be found. Once you shift your perspective and you say that every place is defined in, you know, relative to where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Shechina, is to be mostly found in that place. So now, instead of defining the Oel Moed relative to the Midbar is being defined relative to the Oel Moed. Right? And that's what he goes on to say. I'm sorry? So I'm going to move away from general and specific and use which is defined relative to the other one. Meaning, when we were talking about the Midbar, you know, the Midbar is general and the Oel Moed is specific. I mean, clearly the Oel Moed is smaller in a sense, you know, in a pure geographical sense than the Oel Moed. So then the Midbar. So the Midbar then is general, the Oel Moed is specific. He's actually saying that in a certain sense, the Oel Moed is general and the Midbar is specific in the sense that the Oel Moed is the focal point. It's, in a spiritual sense, the bigger thing, not in a physical, geographical sense, but in a spiritual sense, it's the bigger thing, it's the more important thing, and the Midbar is defined relative to its proximity to the Shechina in the Oel Moed. Right? So in other words, whenever we look at physical, geographical reality, which is important, which is less important, it's always, you know, through the eyes of where the Shechina is to be found. I think... I'm sorry?
Not
peripheral and central. That's a very good way of putting it, right? It's not so much specific versus general, but peripheral versus central. I mean, l'mashal, I forget who made this ha'ara, but one of the gdolim of the 19th century, if I'm not mistaken, made the following ha'ara. He said, you know, from a secular point of view, if you look at the map of Europe, so, you know, Europe in the 19th century, the big cities are St. Petersburg, you know, Moscow, you know, Odessa, you know, you can name off all of the major cities of Eastern Europe. If you look from a Jewish perspective at the major city, you know, if we had a Torah map of Eastern Europe and we had the big dots on that map, we would have Radin, right? We would have Slabodka, we would have, you know, Nevarduk. Chassidisha would have a whole different map, you know, with different big spots, right? But in other words, Radin on a map was a nothing. Mir, I mean, was a hick town, right? But from our point of view, Mir was a huge town, and St. Petersburg was, you know, a village, you know, because Moscow was a village. I mean, how much Torah study was going on in Moscow, where Jews, you know, for most of the 19th century weren't allowed to set foot in Moscow, you know, unless you had a special permit to be able to get in, right? So what makes a place important, I mean, from our point of view, you know, from a secular point of view, one might say, oh, Mir, that's X number of miles from Moscow. From our point of view, we would say, oh, Moscow, that's X number of miles from Mir, right? Because the focal point is what we consider to be important. The Olam Moed was central, again, as Yaakov says. The Midbar was peripheral because that's, you know, that revolved around the Olam Moed. Well, the Pasuk wants to bring out this way of looking at the world to us. So it says as follows, see there samuch lazeh maimer be'echod lachodesh v'ashana hashenis. So it juxtaposes place and time, just as when it comes to place, we start with the peripheral, the smaller thing, and we get to the central, which is the Olam Moed. So too, when it comes to time, we start with the peripheral, the specific date, which is a much smaller slice of time, and then we relate that to the bigger slice of time, the year, also to show what's central and what's more peripheral. It's done specifically this way, in order to help us realize that our perception of relative importance in the realm of space is different than what we might think, you know, off the top of our heads. The Teda, you should know, you should know how distinctive a place where God's presence is to be found in. You should realize that the Olam Moed really is the focal point around which everything else revolves. Mimashim osinu bebeis awa shebein badei ho'aron ondu revochim shishim ribo shol Yisrael. Chazal tell us, you know, based on a pasuk in Yoshua, that all of Klal Yisrael was able to fit between the two badim, the two staves, you know, of the aron. Hare shegam shehu la'ayin muat humerubu l'tzad ha'shochin bo baruch hu. What does that mean? And how do you get all of Klal Yisrael into the two amos, you know, that are between the badim, you know, the staves of the aron? So he says that idea is exactly the same idea that we're bringing out over here in the Pasuk. The Aron, in a certain physical sense, was limited, but in a spiritual sense, it was the focal point, it was the huge point of reference around which everything else revolved. We may think of it as being, you know, the equivalent of the Aron and the Olam Moed as being a two-bit town, you know, which you define relative to the big city, but in reality, the Olam Moed and the Aron was the big city, the focal point of our spatial attention, relative to which we define everything else. Right? So when it comes to space, when it comes to defining places, what matters, says the Aruch Haim, what the Pasuk here is teaching us, what makes a place a great place, a central place, is that that's the place where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to be found. It's not a question of big and small in relative physical terms, right? In other words, if you have a little, you know, if you have a big city, you know, you take a city like New York, right? And, you know, you mention, I don't know, take a street with a, you know, famous shul on it, I don't know, a famous small shul on it, right? mentioned East Broadway. What gives East Broadway its chashivas? Right, MTJ, okay. You know, the yeshiva, the shtibel, whatever it is, you know, it's the place of Torah, the place of Kedusha, that ultimately gives the place its chashivos, its importance, and not the other way around. Right? So that lesson, says the Aruch Chaim, we have right at the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, and although the Aruch Chaim doesn't make this next point, we might say that that's a particularly important point to make right before Kabbalah Satara. Most years, we lay in Bamidbar right before Shavuos, you know, so we should realize, as we're about to read of the revelation of the Torah, that ultimately it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence that makes a place great. Har Sinai by itself is a nothing of a mountain. It's nothing to write home about, right? It wasn't the tourist attraction. It wasn't the highest of all the mountains. But what made Har Sinai special and different, you know, and a holy place, at least temporarily, was the presence of the Shekhinah that was there. Right, so the Aruch Chaim doesn't tip his hand in terms of whether the Medrash is meant literally or metaphorically. What the Aruch Chaim does, though, you know, once the Aruch Chaim says that the idea behind this Medrash is this, you know, different understanding of spatial relationships, it opens up the door, you know, to explain that Medrash metaphorically without having to explain it literally. Now, I don't know that the Aruch Chaim himself would do that. The Aruch Chaim himself might have explained it literally as well, right? And again, it's not a contradiction to say that it's true both literally and metaphorically, but he does open up the door to be able to explain it simply metaphorically. Right. Right. I mean, there, just because of the context, you get the impression that's certainly meant literally, because, you know, that's certainly meant literally, because in the context of Nisim that happened, you know, it's hard for a metaphoric nace, you know, to have the same kind of import. But the hashkafa behind that nace is, why would that be true? You know, that in the Beis HaMikdash they stood, you know, very, you know, like sardines, you know, in a can, and, you know, somehow when they bowed down on the floor, they all found room to be able to bow down. You know, the hashkafa behind that might go back to this idea of how space functions, which is the idea of the Aruch Chaim.
Can that be metaphorically also, the numbers of people?
In what sense?
That could be accommodated there?
In what sense?
We're saying, there's always space, but it's another person.
Right. So what do you want to say there?
Is it metaphoric, or is it literal?
Meaning what? Meaning in the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, right, that they were standing like sardines, right, and they would fall down, they would have room to...
Everybody.
Right, so I think the simple pshat in that Mishnah Pirkei Avos is that it's meant literally, because again, if you're describing nisim that happened, miracles that happened, it's not so much of a miracle if it didn't really happen, right? I mean, part of what makes it a miracle is that it literally took place. I mean, you know, for metaphoric miracles, I don't know how much they're worth exactly, but that would be my guess in that statement of Pirkei Avos. Okay, another Aruch Chaim. We'll take a look on page Dalet, which is Pasuk Lamed Tes. Again, Perek Gimel Pasuk Lamed Tes. Of course, we know that Bamidbar, primarily, you know, the parsha itself primarily talks about the Pikudim, you know, the census that was taken of the various different Shvatim. And the Aruch Chaim quotes the Ramban, who has a very strong question that he doesn't understand about the whole Pekudim. So, called Pekudei Alevim, the Pasuk in Lamed Tes lists off the number of Levim who were there in the desert. And the Ramban Zal, Toma B'dov Sheish L'Smo'abo, Ki Alevim Hein Heino Yedidei Hashem Ukrovov, Asher Lochatu Bo'ega V'lo Nikfu V'lo Hargu V'lo Hushku, Ve'ich L'Smatu Kol Kach Mikol HaShvotim, Shere Magim B'Spon Ben Chodesh L'Chatsi Shev HaKodesh Shebi Yisrael. If you go through the actual numbers, a lot of us go through Bamidbar, we don't actually read the numbers, right? It's just, you know, okay, this, yeah, whatever it is. If you read the numbers, the Levim were less than half of the smallest of the other Shvatim. They were tiny relative to the other Shvatim. And the Ramban says, you know, that's bizarre. The Levim, you know, you would think would be the holiest of all the Shvatim, you would think that God would reward them by increasing them, you know, to be a huge number, much more than the other Shvatim. And yet we find that they barely had any population increase. I mean, you know, they're tiny. They're less than half of the smallest of the other Shvatim. Ukshatamod al-Misparim ben Chof le'agir l'shlish l'reviyah. Right? And the Levim, remember, are not even counted from the age of 20 like the rest of the Shvatim are. They're counted from the age of 30 days. So when you start making a cheshbon and you realize that A, they're less than half the size, B, even that number is artificially inflated because you're counting, you know, you're counting 1 month olds as opposed to 20 year olds. So the truth is they come up to being maybe a third or a fourth of the rest of the Shvatim. Okay, so let's talk about that in a minute, because the Ramban himself is going to say something similar, and the Arachayim is going to pilpul back and forth in the words of this Ramban. Says the Arachayim, the Ramban himself answers his own question in two different ways. Number one, right? Why did the rest of the Shvatim increase in such a dramatic fashion? So the Pasuk says, "V'kasher yanu also ken yirbe v'chen yifrotz." The more they were tortured, the more they increased. Right? Those the incredible miracle of the sextuplets. Right? You know that Yaldu Shisha v'Kerasecha, that every mother when she gave birth to six all at once. That was in response to the tortures of the Sheba, the tortures of the subjugation. Ironically, since the Levim weren't part of the subjugation, they weren't enslaved in Egypt, so they didn't get the tortures, but they didn't get this miraculous growth either. Right? So that's the Ramban suggests, that's where the Ma'amal always got it from. The Ma'amal always got it from the Ramban. You know, the Ramban says that, you know, since the Levim were left alone by Paro, ironically, again, it's ironic, but okay, it is what it is. Ironically, they didn't have this population explosion, you know, like the other.
It's ironically, no pain, no gain.
Right, no pain, no gain. Right, that's exactly it. Right, and the Ramban, by the way, says, L'chora, you see that in the very story of Moshe Rabbeinu. Right, because, again, if it's true that Yaldu Shisha B'Keres Echad, right, that every woman who gave birth really gave birth to six at one time, so then, what happened to Moshe Rabbeinu's other siblings? Right? We know about Miriam, we know about Aaron. Moshe Rabbeinu was born, right? There should be another 15 kids in the equation there somewhere. Where'd they go? Right? We never hear about Moshe, Aaron, and my other 15 siblings. Right? So according to the Ramban, it fits in very nicely. Yeah, they were from Shevet Levi. They didn't have the Shisha B'Keres Echad. You know, this miraculous population growth. That's one answer the Ramban gives. The Derech Beis, the second answer, B'tam Kassel Sheyakov Avinu Olav HaShalom, says the Ramban, you know, it goes as much as the Levim were a holy tribe, you know, because they were involved in Torah. But remember, Yaakov Avinu, going back a couple of generations, was incredibly angry at Levi for his role in the destruction of Shechem. And he cursed Levi together with Shimon. So, you know, yeah, the Levim rehabilitated themselves, but they were still, on some level, suffering from the curse of Yaakov Avinu, right? Achal kim b'Yaakov afitzer b'Yisrael. I'm going to scatter them throughout the Jewish people, meaning they're numerically, they're never going to grow up to be as big as the other Shvatim, right? So, yes, they were holy, but they were also cursed going back to Yaakov. That's the second shot, which the Ramban brings.
Father, he curses or he punches him. Does he really mean it?
No, yeah, okay.
He said if you would have known the thing, he did it a bit of backward.
He didn't smash them, he didn't destroy them, but he limited their population growth. Right. So even with that, in other words, even with the people who died and the rest of Klal Yisrael, the Levim was so far behind that they still didn't catch up, even with the, you know, the other people dying from the rest of Klal Yisrael. Zach Yavsai.
Hashem designates them to
right.
serve him.
Right.
So in the deed they have that pocket and that people, why are they made less, why are they less dependent? So why are they made more dependent and they become part of the quartet of the Yosef among the But why, if they're, if they have this particular honor, why would they then be dependent on and part of that group, which is not the very dependent status, is being diminished?
Right. I mean, it's an interesting question. Why are the Levim lumped together with the other, you know, the Yosom, the Alman of the Ger, you know, people who are dependent on others? I think that's probably done the Kavon. In other words, the Ribbono Shel Olam, A, wants the Levim to be focused on spiritual matters, not on pursuing Parnasa. B, he wants the rest of Klal Yisrael to feel this Achrayus towards the people who are teaching them Torah. And C, you know, perhaps HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not want the teachers of Torah to become too rich and too non-dependent on others, because that would not be good for them spiritually. You know, you know, if they had, you know, just consolidation, I mean, again, Lahavdil, you think of the Catholic Church in Europe in the Middle Ages, where, you know, they had the power, they had the control, they had the money, and they were totally corrupt. You know, again, you know, Lahavdil, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you know, that, you know, perhaps taking power away from them would keep them honest, you know, in many ways. Perhaps that was the cheshbon that the Torah had. Right? In any case, those are the two pshatim of the Rambam. The Archaim says, I for sure don't like the second pshat, right, of the Rambam. Namely, that Yaakov's curse somehow kept the numbers of the Levim low. He says, I find the second explanation of the Rambam very far-fetched. Where do we see anywhere that, you know, that Yaakov's Avinu's anger at them should, you know, should impact on them in such a way? Nimsu shosifu dalit chalakim bekerav al mispaseh. Right? You see that in a later point in time, the Levim increase incredibly. Uva mispar b'nei Yisrael, bo shom lo bo lo kefo mispar ha'omer kan, va omen mispar zeh kishiyo nimnim ben chofa ben meo v'malo kedersh nim Yisrael, yachol yos mispar kegodo shifte Yisrael u'malo v'ayikas aviyam. Right? If you follow Levim through history, they do continue to increase. So, if you tell me that the Levim are perpetually doomed because of the curse of Yaakov Avinu, well, it's not true. You know, you keep following them through time, you know, they do increase incredibly. Right, and that's also true. Right, and that's also true. I mean, look at Shimon. I mean, Shimon, if anything, was the ringleader, you know, more so than Levi. And Shimon doesn't seem to have been subjected to the same population, you know, curtailment. Right, so that's the you know, the Archaim says, I'm not happy with the second pshat of the Ramban. I don't really like the first pshat of the Ramban either, says the Archaim. He goes on to say, on the one hand, the notion that the Levim were not included in the Shibud, and that you know, because of that, they didn't have this miraculous increase, that's true. But it won't fit, in Ramban's pshat runs afoul of a medrash that says that the Jews went from 70 to 600,000 in the lifetime of Yaakov Avinu himself. Right, so this incredible population growth, which was spurred on by the sextuplets, right, took place before the Shibud. Right, Yaakov, as long as Yaakov Avinu was alive, well, the midwives come later on, right? And as the midwives come after the Jews are enslaved, if it's true, as the Medrash says, that the incredible population growth of the Jewish people precedes the servitude, the slavery in Egypt, so then it should have impacted upon Levi equally and proportionately. Right? So even if you want to tell me that after the slavery began, you know, the Levium didn't continue to increase at the same rate as the rest of the Jewish people, but still they got a pretty good head start with everybody else, you know, as long as Yaakov Avinu was alive. Right, they went out with Shishim Rebo, right. So, I mean, I think what you have to say is that whatever population growth they had was curtailed by all the people who died. You know, remember, if you put that together with Chazal, who say 4/5 died during Makas Choshech, so the truth is, there was a huge population growth, but then they came back to Shishim Rebo, you know, right before Yetzias Mitzrayim. So, you know, the two Midrashim work together very nicely. You know, they reached a certain plateau. They continued to increase. I mean, they multiplied fivefold, you know, over the next couple of decades, but then they were scaled back, you know, during the Makas Choshech. So if you want to follow that Medrash, says the Arachayim, you have to say, Ki Omro Kain Yirbe, Pirush Kemo Kain, V'Shir Harishon Yirbe, V'Lohaya Mismait. Meaning, the Egyptians killed many Jews during the slavery, but, you know, the Jews didn't increase during those years, but at least they stayed stable. In other words, you know, it gives you some sense of how many Jews the Egyptians were killing off. You know, the Egyptians basically brought about zero population growth. They killed off as many Jews as new Jews were being born. But yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Jewish people a promise that once the Jews hit 600,000, they will stay at that number even through the years of slavery. Right? So, the Jewish people, it's not that they increased numerically so much from the time of Yaakov Avinu's death, because they had already reached 600,000, but they, qualitatively, they were more in your face, you know, they were running for public office, you know, they were, much more visible from a, you know, from a qualitative point of view. So if that's the case, again, according to this Medrash, the population explosion preceded the slavery. If that's the case, Shevet Levi should be no different than anybody else. Don't say, yes, they were on the same level, you know, the same number before the slavery began, but then, you know, God caused this miracle to take place that the other Shvatim were increasing at record numbers in order to compensate for the number of Jews who died. Why should the Levium, if the Levium at one point were equal in number, more or less, to the rest of the Shvatim, why should they go down? Why should they lose out just because they're Levium? Right? Okay. The next paragraph. What seems correct to me is as follows. Ki Shevet Levi Maisa Echolem Ke Maisa Amram. You know, we all know, Rashi brings on Chumash, that Amram, you know, the father of Moshe Rabbeinu, when he saw that the Jewish people were having a hard time, you know, in Mitzrayim, he said, look, why should we bring any more children into the world? And he went and he divorced his wife. And we know that Miriam, you know, their daughter, basically convinced Amram to take her back, to remarry her, and, you know, that's when Moshe Rabbeinu was born. Everybody knows that Medrash Rashi brings it in his commentary to Chumash. Posits the Arachayim, Amram was just an example which was commonplace in Shevet Levi. Amram divorced his wife. Most of the Levium divorced their wives during the years of Shibud. But unlike Amram, who remarried her, most of the other Levium did not take back their wives. And as a result, if they didn't take back their wives, so they had zero population growth among the Levium. And hence, by the time the Jews leave Mitzrayim, the Levium are a fraction of the rest of the Shvatim, because with all of the other tzaras that the Jews are having in Mitzrayim, at least they are having babies. The Levim are not having any babies at all, or virtually no babies at all. Avram was the exception, who remarried his wife. Vatam, why would that be? Why did the Levim, Davka, divorce their wives and not the rest of the Shvatim? Litzad shahayu me'unagim, lo nishtadu, lo nones levavim kol kach liros nideim ushlochim vayor. Kemaisa ish Yisrael, Hashem Yitzhar HaShibot, ve'ol ho'avodom, Huzal v'hukal v'einem uvelibom liros yaldei mushlochim bayor gam shoyu mizalzlim ba'atzmelei leiv la'azov besados v'mechilos sa'ores asher in odom nichbon shenavshu mechuberes alav k'shevet levi osekei. It's a fascinating insight. Well, let me just try to paraphrase as much as I understand it. You know, one of the things that slavery does to people, it not only makes them work hard, but it dehumanizes them. And says the Arachayim, the rest of the Shvatim were so dehumanized by the slavery, they didn't mind having kids. Look, we'll have kids. If it's a girl, we'll keep the child. If it's a boy, okay, so they might throw the child into the Nile. We'll deal with it. You know, it's a certain callous attitude, but it's an attitude that's born of the dehumanization that takes place when people are slaves. Hey, we'll try our luck, whatever, if it's a girl, or, you know, 50-50 chance. We know Chazal also tells the Gemara in Sota that the women would go, and they would give birth out in the fields, and leave the babies out in the fields, and the Malachim would come down and take care of the babies. Now, that only works if you're, at a certain level, dehumanized, you know, or desensitized to the suffering the child is going to endure. What mother in her right mind says, look, I'm going to get pregnant, and when the time comes to give birth, I'm going to give birth in the middle of the field, leave the kid there, and whatever happens, happens. Right? You can definitely see where somebody would say, no, that's crazy. I don't want to have kids under those kind of circumstances. The Levim, because they weren't subjugated, had that, were not dehumanized to the same extent. And Dafka for the Levim, it was harder for them to contemplate the notion of having children and potentially exposing them to all of these difficulties and suffering. They made the conscious choice not to have kids. The rest of Klal Yisrael said, no, we're going to take our chances, we're going to have kids, and, you know, if they survive, good. If not, we tried. You know, on one level it's heroic, on the other level, you know, you're not sure whether it's heroic or callous. I mean, you could read it either way, but because the other people went through the Shibud, they were okay with this idea of having children. Levim davka stopped. V'zelach ha'os ki Amram shilach es ishto. Amram sent away his wife, he divorced his wife. L'husrach ha'kosav l'diyayis ha'dovah shigam v'amram l'hirik ha'kosav o'inyam en l'haskos o'inyam noda. Amram wasn't unique. All of them were divorcing their wives. Well, Lamed al Koshifto Yotza. He was just, you know, he was just an example thereof. There's always Sibas Miutam. That's why there were so few Levim. Kim Ein Gedoyim Ein Tiyoshim. Right? If you're not going to bring children into the world, there won't be any adults, right? In the end of the day. The Gam Shemavsinu Shamu Hechzir Grushaso Ein Lomobim Mera Shukulam Hechziru. Right, Amram was unique in that he took back his wife because Miriam told him, I had a nevuah, I had a prophecy that your son is going to be Moshiach Shel Yisrael, is going to be the one who's going to save the Jewish people. But the other families of the Levim didn't have such a prophecy, so they didn't take back their wives. I'm just going to skip down a little bit. Vim Tomer, Lama Shevet Ben Torah Yasem Yopiria Verivya. So isn't that bizarre? That Dafka, the Shevet of Torah, would refrain from the mitzvah of Pru Urvu? No, not so bizarre. They had a cheshbon. They said, what's Pru Urvu? If we're going to have the kids, and the kids are going to be killed, or likely to be killed, so what's the point? Pru Urvu is not just churn out babies. Pru Urvu is bring children into the world who are going to survive. If you think the kids don't have a good chance of surviving, so they said, we don't have a mitzvah pru'urvu. We find the Gemara, we're going to hit it in Tainus pretty soon. The Gemara says in Tainus that a couple is not supposed to have relations during years of famine. Why not? So the way the Arachaim understands that is that if you're going to bring children into the world during a famine where they're likely to die because there's a famine, what's the point? Pru Urvu is not just a quantitative mitzvah about churning out kids, it's qualitative. You want to give them a quality of life. Okay, but it's 50-50, right? In other words, you know, they don't know. I mean, they didn't have genetic engineering, you know, that they could, you know, make it girls. So they said, look, why should we bring some... I'm sorry? Why should we bring a child into the world? Was there a 50% chance the child's going to be killed? Right? You know, they said, you know, so the way the Archaim learns this Isser of being Mishamish Mitos B'Shnas Rava, right, of having relations during years of famine, is that the mitzvah Pru Urvu is suspended because of the fact that they're going to likely die when they come into the world. They made the cheshbon that if, you know, we're going to have a male child, the child is not going to survive, or likely not going to survive, so better that we should stop, you know, having kids altogether. The truth is, when you think of it in those terms, if the vast majority of the Levium separated from their wives, the fact that there any Levium left was a miracle. Right? I guess not everybody separated from their wives, right? But I mean, the fact that there was anybody left was miraculous. So that's why we find that although the Levium in the beginning of Bar Midbar were relatively few, later on in history we find that they did increase tremendously, because, you know, after the years of the Shibud and Mitzrayim, they went back to regular family relations, and they grew, just like the rest of the Shvatim, right? So, essentially, the Levium and Mitzrayim, says the Arachaim, engaged in population control, right? In other words, they were bedavka, not having children. Nothing to do with Yaakov's curse, right? In other words, they made a cheshbon based on the fact that they were afraid of bringing children into a world which was likely going to kill them. So they said, we're not going to have kids. We're not going to have kids.
Psychologically
damaged. Yeah, okay. Or killed. Getting killed is pretty bad. Yeah. Right. Mishar Shmitasa on the table. Right.
Is that related to a Shnas
Ravon? Right. That may be, it's interesting. I think that the conventional pshat in Shnas Ravon is, you know, if everyone else is suffering, it's not about Pru Urvu. Right. So I guess the Arachaim is not rejecting that reason. Right, but he's saying, in addition to that, notice, it's one thing to say that we should curtail our pleasure and enjoyment, you know, because other people are suffering. That's fine, but there's still a mitzvah of Pru Urvu. How does Pru Urvu, you know, get set aside because, you know, the world is at famine? So that's the Arachaim is saying, in addition to the idea that, you know, that we shouldn't be enjoying ourselves while the world is suffering, we also shouldn't be bringing children into a world where they're likely going to die. Who knows when the famine is going to be over, right? So, you know, I think both ideas are correct. According to the Arachaim, I'm sorry.
They had a machlokas with Miriam.
Well, Miriam, the way the Arachaim presents it, was only able to convince Amram because she said, "I have an avua that you're going to have a kid who's going
to
survive."
But how are you doing it? Right.
I mean, the way... Right. So it's interesting. The way the Arachaim presents it, she really made two arguments. One was that logical argument. The other was, by the way, I happen to know your son is going to make it. He's going to be Moshe Yonshel Yisrael. So it seems as if the Levium, you know, bought one half of the argument, they rejected the other half of the argument. Right? They bought the half of the argument, you know, that was relevant to Amram, but as pertains to them, you know, the idea that we might as well try, and, you know, whatever we get, you know, we'll get 5 out of 10, that they rejected. They said, no, that's not correct. Okay. We wish everybody a good Shabbos, a good Yom Tov, and Kabbalah Satara B'Simcha.